I think one of the things I find that's always helpful is not being afraid to be vulnerable and to talk about some of the mistakes and the challenges and the lessons that we've learned. And I think in some ways that can invite others to be open and know that you can fall down and you can just get right back up.
This is Teaching Today, brought to you by the Center for the Professional Education of Teachers at Teachers College, Columbia University. In conversation with researchers, teachers, and school leaders, we are dedicated to breaking down the problems, policies, and promising practices that define teaching today. Uniting theory and practice, CPET promotes rigorous and relevant scholarship and is committed to making excellent education accessible worldwide through personalized professional development. In 2021, CPET announced on our podcast that we were adding a sixth core principle that would guide and ground our work in coaching. It was culturally relevant, responsive, and sustaining pedagogy, or what we call for short, CRSP. Don't count the R's. It doesn't add up, but it's in our heart. As a core principle, we consider it to be our responsibility to incorporate CRSP into all of our projects. This means that in every project, we recognize that whether we're working with teachers, students, or school leaders, we cannot separate an individual from their identity. And as a result, we need to incorporate each person's cultural identity into our instruction, whether that's professional development or classroom teaching, in order to engage them, to help them to learn, and to help them to grow. In many ways, this is how we are coaching for change. It's also why I'm glad to have with us members of CPET's leadership team who can speak to how we're incorporating CRSP into our Coaching for Change online course, our curriculum for our new coaches, and in our conversation today, we'll dig into some of the challenges that we encounter when coaching with an equity lens. So let's get to it. I'm Roberta Langer-Kang, the director of the Center for Professional Education of Teachers at Teachers College, and I'm here today with my colleague Courtney Brown, Senior Professional Development Advisor, our new teacher network at TC Initiative Leader, and a Secondary Ed Specialist. Hey, Court.
Hi, Roberta. So happy to be here with you guys.
We're also joined by G. Faith Little, our Initiative Director for 21st Century Learning. Hey, G.
Hey, y'all.
And I'm very, very happy to have with us today Dr. Charisse Holloman, who is formerly of CPET and is currently the Director of Diversity and Inclusion at a private school in Brooklyn. Welcome, Charisse.
Listen, once CPET, always CPET.
Girl, you know it.
Absolutely.
Exactly. So we know that there are four entry points for us in approaching the diversity, equity, and inclusion work in professional learning. As part of our framework, we're looking at developing CRSP in our projects through these four entry points. The first entry point is around curriculum development, the second around data-driven inquiry, the third, me and my community, looking at our identities and how we interact with each other, and the fourth entry point is looking at shared language and history. Now, we don't believe that any one of these entry points is the is-all and be-all of culturally relevant, responsive, and sustaining pedagogy, but we believe that each one provides a particular entry point based on the context that the school or the organization is ready for and is most interested in. And that once you get in, sort of once you get your foot in the door, that all of the other ones actually come in cycles or sequences and they can follow. And that when you have all four combined, you're really developing the fabric of being in an anti-racist and anti-biased in educational environment. It's, I think, fair to say, easier said than done. And so the purpose of our conversation today is to dig into those entry points a little bit more and talk about maybe just some of the surprising challenges that that can bring with it. You know, when I first announced that we had brought the sixth core principle into, you know, our grounding values, I sort of share that, like, well, of course we're always doing this and we always have been doing this. We just haven't been explicit about it because it sort of seemed like it went without saying. What we've learned in the past few years is that no, it actually needs to be said. And I think what we've learned after saying it out loud is like, oh, there are lots of challenges and there are some surprising challenges that can come with it. So I want to begin with curriculum development, which every school everywhere is always doing all the time. What are we looking at in terms of some of the challenges that come alongside curriculum development with a CRSP lens?
As you guys know, here at CPET, we're really doing so much exciting work thinking about curriculum and CRSP alignment. We're doing it across districts, right? We're doing it for specific schools. And so I feel like we've learned so much and are constantly learning about this. And I think that one thing to talk about challenges, right? One thing is that if you're going to sort of purchase a vetted curriculum or a curriculum that's already developed, chances are that it's really going to need to be adjusted to be culturally relevant and also sustaining for your students. And what I mean by that is that it's generally generic, right? Oh, these are good books to be read, or we think nationwide. But what we really want to be looking at with curriculum is adjusting vetted and pre-made curriculum to meet our students where they're at and to offer them, to use the terms that I think are so important in thinking about curriculum, mirrors and windows for their actual experiences, so that it's about our students. What are the demographics of our students? What are their interests? Who are they? And then how are we choosing or adapting aspects of the curriculum, if we have one that we're given or purchased? How are we adapting it so that our students can see themselves in the content, in the what? And how are we adapting it so that they're also not just mirroring their own experiences or cultural backgrounds, for example, but offering them windows into other worlds, into other experiences, and really being explicit about that. So I feel like that's kind of CRSP curricular alignment, like 101, right? And that's happening in a lot of districts. We see it where states and districts are adopting curriculum that's already made. And I just want to say that the challenge is, it's not just plug and play. It really has to be looked at, adapted. And I think that some of those conversations need to be around who are our students, and not being generic about that. Like, oh, all my students are African-American. Well, really? Do all your students have kind of the same background, the same experiences? Or if you scratch the surface, are some students from a West Indian background? Are some students actually African immigrants, first generation? Like, let's really begin to understand who our students are and what will help support them to feel like their experiences are acknowledged and celebrated. And then how do we expand their range and their vision so that they are learning about people different from them? And obviously this goes across different disciplines and looks a little different, and the conversations might be different depending on the discipline that you're in, right? So in science, you might be making some different choices than like the text that you're choosing or focusing on in an ELA classroom. So that's the beginning of my soapbox on some of the challenges. I just also want to outline that another challenge is that we all come to curriculum with our biases. So whether we're developing our own or we are using vetted curriculum, we can't always see beyond what we've experienced or what we think is culturally relevant, right? So I feel like that's been an area that I've really been working with schools and teachers on, trying to figure out, is this relevant for our students and how do we make it more relevant? Or are we assuming that this is going to work? Are we assuming that this is the way to do good curriculum? But is it really culturally relevant and sustaining to our students?
And for me, I just want to also add to everything that you're saying is, I think even when schools embark on the endeavor to like begin having these conversations, like I think it can pose a challenge because, like you said, people are coming from many different backgrounds. But I think just the fact of beginning to have the conversations and finding comfort in the discomfort, and knowing that that's just part of how it goes, because I think, you know, one of our other C's is talking about critical reflection and our cycle of inquiry, because like it's always a circular, like we're always just learning and revising and learning and revising. So I would say for people to also show themselves a little bit of grace as they're venturing into this work.
That's right. And offer each other grace. They might be messy, those conversations, right, Charisse? And they might be uncomfortable. And we need to have them and create safe spaces where we feel like we can be vulnerable having those conversations and admitting some of our own biases and letting other people grapple with theirs.
One of the challenges I think that comes up in coaching for curriculum development is when you do have a diverse population, that sometimes what is a window for some students is a mirror for others. And that they, and that sometimes, like if you're reading a text or looking at a particular lens in history, you might have people who identify with different cultural groups be in the room. And so talking about the immigration story and the challenge that somebody's had going from their home country, leaving in strife and coming to the US, you know, for some people, that's an eye-opening experience. And for other people, that's their memoir. And the reactions that they have and the ways in which they experience that content are very, very different. And I think that's something that teachers have to grapple with when they're making some of those curricular choices, to be able to anticipate how are my students who come from different backgrounds going to either relate or not be able to relate to this? Is this going to be an eye-opening unit, or is this going to be something actually that maybe brings up old traumas or something that's cathartic because people can relate to it? That it's just one of the complexities I think that you may not think about when you're beginning to embark on this work.
Roberta, just to build on that, I'm really happy that you brought that up, because that's where the curriculum that we choose or develop and that we try to strive to align to CRSP kind of moves into pedagogy. How are we implementing it, right? And how are we using that curriculum once we feel like, okay, this is something that I want to pilot, given that we might have diverse experiences in the classroom. So really allowing students to question and to inquire into whose story is this, for example, or what was the impact of this across disciplines and who benefited from this? And is there bias here? And really allowing those conversations to take place with whatever curriculum you're using.
Well, I think one of the tips that we could probably all talk about is having some protocols in place. Roberta, you just mentioned anticipating. So let's anticipate that it's a troubling story and there may be characters in that story, true stories, right, that oppressed other people. And maybe that's what I look like. And maybe that's for me, oh my gosh, what is my responsibility? Now I might get emotionally bothered about that. It might be difficult. So anticipating that and being able to understand, let's have a protocol. Let's talk about putting things into context and then providing a safe place for everyone to be able to share. And to already go ahead and talk about, so what happens if we get feelings about this? What are we going to do? How do we handle our feelings in the classroom? It's going to be a very important thing to plan ahead on.
And Faith, I think you're already touching on another touch point, which is entry point rather, which is about the community and me and the identity and like all of the SEL, because we have to consider the personal experience and how things can be potential triggers. And one of the things that I think that does is when we think about the community, I always think about getting to know your community. And I mean, really know your students, so that this way we may not be able to anticipate everything, but we can have a sense of what have been some of their experiences. And I think, you know, that really comes into the kind of defines what we mean when we say culturally responsive, because we want to be responsive to the students that are in front of us. So I think that can be challenging at times, because you have many students, you have, if you're teaching a lot of classes, then how are you having deep and building relationships with your students? And I think some of the ways that we found to be successful is, like, I love when we used to do the activity where we have the pictures with all the images, and the students, you know, could just choose an image. We've done this with adults, you know, we've done it with each other. And it's always interesting to see the images that people choose and what we learn in that moment. So I think there are other ways when we can incorporate ways of learning, ways of knowing, that doesn't necessarily mean sitting down and saying, Courtney, tell me about all of the traumas in your life so I can make sure I never touch on them, you know. So I think it just all really comes together. I don't see how we can do any one of these without the other. Like, they really come together, and they really, you know, we have to have the shared language. We're talking about the community, the SEL. We're looking at how does all of this show up in the curriculum, and then what's the data that we're using to, like, really tell us that this is working.
Charissa, I just love that you have made the connections to the other entry points, because you're absolutely right. As soon as you get into one, all of a sudden you're starting to tap and push into the others. I think that, you know, looking, we're thinking about curriculum. One of the pro tips that I was thinking about is, like, always wanting to have some kind of a framework or an outside benchmark to help you to say, what are some of our expectations that we're going to use to ensure we're aligning with culturally relevant, responsive, and sustaining practices, and using the outside framework. But the other component is absolutely getting to know my students and making sure that I understand who's in the room and what has their experience been. And then, to your point, community and me as educators, especially, we have a lot of power in our classroom spaces. We have a lot of power in our school and power over our students. And if we're not considering the ways in which our culture plays into that power dynamic, then we're missing some of the conversation, and we're likely to be surprised about how some of these experiences roll out. And so that very important work of really kind of unpacking my own culture, my own identity, and also the identity of my students. And Faith, you said this really well, creating some norms or using some protocols to help us to talk about when we have surprising feelings. I mean, I feel like this is one of the reasons why this is such an important topic for us to talk about, but also in our culture, it's such a political hot button, because we are so concerned with how we will deal with students and with adults who realize that they have some emotional reactions or responses to talking about equity and inequity. And it's easy to talk about equity. It is very difficult to talk about inequity and each of our roles that we play in that. And that's, to your point, Charisse, where that community and me component comes. And to your point, Faith, that it's really valuable to anticipate, this might be emotional. This, we might have some challenges here. What are some resources I want to bring? Or what are some ways that we're going to talk about affirming one another? What are some ways that we can talk about the here and now, the present, what's happening right now, and what we're each responsible for that we do in our own lives, and also how we come from a history and a lived experience of our history and our ancestors, and that we can create change for tomorrow. Charisse, you also talked about data and how looking at the data can be an entry point into talking about equity. And I feel like, to the same question around, well, what are some of the problematic challenges that come around coaching for, you know, community and me when we're unpacking our culture, those same things come out in the data, because data is so personal. When, you know, I do a workshop on data and I talk about, you know, it can either be like a blueprint and a map for where you want to go, or it can be an interrogation lamp that's like bleeding down. Like, I'll tell you anything. I'm sorry. Like, I don't know why they failed. So the intensity with which, because for so long we've been told the message that, like, you are your data, that your value and your worth is tied into how other people perform on a test that you didn't design. And the challenge is that data is a really great and objective place to say, some students are performing here, other students are performing here. And we have to ask ourselves the question, what accounts for that difference? And if we're not willing to say, if we see patterns and trends in performance data that goes along subgroup lines. So whether those are ethnicity lines or gender lines or housing lines or economic lines, what have you, exactly. If we see consistent patterns and trends that track based on cultural identity, and we don't go, that's weird. If we're not willing to say, well, I guess, you know, some poor kids just aren't as smart as rich kids. If I don't feel comfortable saying that, then I have to acknowledge when the data represents with that disproportionality that some of my students' needs aren't getting met. And this is a really big thing to think about, especially looking at the demographic makeup of your population, because some of those subgroups might be very small numbers. I can have a 95% pass rate and have more than 50% of my Latinx students fail. And even though it might only be 10 out of 200 kids, that's still a significant portion. So as a result, I have to be looking not just at the number of students and how they're performing on outside measures, but I also have to acknowledge how do the performance trends appear when we begin to look at them in subgroups. And then I have to, and I think one of the challenges that emerges is when we say, oh no, I feel like somebody might call me out, or I feel like I get so afraid of what the data might represent that I can't actually engage with it or be curious about it because I'm feeling already immediately defensive. So what we want to, you know, help people to do is, I think that's one of the challenges is like when we see, oh, this sort of immediate walls going up and a resistance to looking at data or a resistance to seeing the data as valid because I'm afraid of what it might mean. And if we can move away from some of those fears, some promising practices are to get curious about it and to be able to see the power in knowing, oh my gosh, 10 of my students are not picking up what I'm putting down. I got to figure that out. I could try talking to them and seeing what's working and not working for them. And that data is sort of like turning on the light and being able to see in some of the hidden spaces that I couldn't see without it. It also helps us to recognize that sometimes those objective and outside measures are not equitable. And that also presents a challenge, but that's a challenge that I need to confront and I need to work with.
And Roberta, I also think that I was just coming from some data meetings today. We were looking at subgroups, and sometimes as a teacher, if you're fearful and you're personalizing some of your students' achievement and you make some changes and you take some risks, and for example, we as coaches support those changes, you might see evidence in the students' progress in the data. And the data might begin to actually confirm that, hey, I do have the power and my students have the power to make positive change and begin to achieve if I make some shifts. So it can also support you to feel really good about what you're doing when you see students progress and achieve.
Yeah, and that's because you didn't ignore the data or you didn't shy away from it in fear that it might say something you don't want to admit to.
That's right. That's right. You know, I was also thinking as you guys were talking about data and Roberta was talking so beautifully about how we personalize it and how it might bring up for us sort of like, I'm a good person. What do you mean? All my students in this group are not doing well. I don't have a lot of biases, and it can actually create defensiveness and we can shut down, right? We feel a little personally affronted and responsible. So I think that one thing that we've done at CPET, and I know that you guys have all been involved in this and Faith has actually taught a course on it, is that if we step out of ourselves and out of our group or our school, we can actually read other people's voices and we can do a book study and bring in some other voices, theory and research that can kind of depersonalize it and help us kind of step out of our own lenses and bring another person or another discussion to the table. So I just wondered, I know that you know, we at CPET and you guys have done book groups with some wonderful, wonderful books. And I'm thinking about some of the work Goldie Muhammad has done and Bettina Love and Ibram Kendi as just some favorite examples. But Faith, would you like to tell us a little bit about how book groups and some of that work can really support CRSP?
I think one of the things that we may know or we may want to remember or learn is that being able to read a book together can remove it a little bit. Like, we can then be curious, who is this person, Abram? Like, what is he saying? And what's his experience? And we can validate, we can say, yeah, I validate that experience. This is someone else's experience, not my own. And it can make it, I don't know if I want to say easier, but it can remove it in a way so that when we read it, we can receive it and be curious about it. And so I think that's a really big advantage to doing a book group on any number of people's stories that are other than our own, but certainly particularly around equity. That's really important to hear from people and hear and get those windows into other people's experiences. And then to be able to challenge ourselves, because there will be challenging times in them, to say, oh, so I want to say I'm not a racist, but am I anti-racist? Am I taking action and being anti-racist? And what does that mean to me? And so a book group gives you the opportunity to have those conversations. We did that with our staff, and we did turn it into a course as well. And it was an amazing opportunity for us to create workshops for each other. And anybody could do that and repeat that experiment to put something together for your staff or for your students that is a nice workshop to consider our part in what role do we play. And what do we understand, and what do we maybe want to understand more?
I just want to build, Faith, that some of the work that I've seen you do, and of course that we strive to do, it allows people to enter into dialogue and create a common language around some things that some people might feel really uncomfortable about. So talking about racism, talking about equity, talking about our own biases, because the author of the book, or you know, the language in the book is offering us that gift. It's already there for us. And we don't have to kind of take it on ourselves. I don't want to say it's easier, but it allows us to use the language that's presented to us and defined.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it's more like it gives us some handles, and it can feel really slippery and like, I'm not sure where to grab onto this, but it gives us some handles. It doesn't Absolutely. Make it easier.
I love that analogy, Faith. I think that's a really, really great way to look at it. And I also think that, you know, we've been talking about this work and doing this work for many, many years. So I think that even as, you know, different schools, different communities are thinking about embarking upon this, to just remember to kind of like go slow, you know, just start small. You know, we want to think big, but start small so that it doesn't become too overwhelming. Because what do you always say, Roberta? It's not a race. It's a, what do you say, a journey? How do you say it, Roberta?
It's not a marathon. It's the, are you talking about running hurdles?
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So often we think that we're in this big, long race, and it's a marathon, and that we all start at the starting line, and then we like pick our pace, and we find our group, and we run with our group for a really, really, really long way, all at the same pace. Then we arrive at the finish line together. But the reality of it is that teaching and learning is so much more like hurdles, that we're sprinting from the starting line until we reach that first obstacle, which may be visible or invisible, if we're being honest. And my ability to negotiate that hurdle, and that to negotiate that obstacle, is going to either set me up to land on my feet and keep sprinting forward, or to fall on my face. And when I fall on my face, I have to pick myself up and go back to the starting line and start again. And when you keep falling down and hitting those obstacles, it really puts you further and further behind.
It also gives us an opportunity. I guess maybe I'm looking at it in another way as well. And that is, I hit the hurdle. I didn't know it was there. Oh my gosh, I had no idea that was triggering to me. And now boom, I'm down, right? And then I go, okay, start over. Okay. But now I know that hurdle is there. And I can say, how do I jump higher to get over it? What do I need to do in my own self-care or my learning or whatever it is to get over the hurdle? So then every single time we can pick ourselves up and say, okay, what did I learn there? Great. I'm going to go out. I'm going to go again. And then you just build a lot of perseverance. And then I just think about the community that's around you as well. You're not really picking yourself up yourself. Like, you have people around you and you can support one another to get up, and you can also support each other to see the hurdles. Hey, by the way, there could be a hurdle today, so be sure to take care of yourself in these ways.
I really liked that we're bringing the conversation back around to the fourth entry point of just thinking about a shared language and history, because the benefit there is that not everyone in my community has done the same work personally, has done the same reading, is familiar with the same vocabulary. We all come from, you know, different places and different levels of experience, personal and learned experiences and lived experiences. So when you embark on reading a shared text or creating new definitions of terms, that work can help create a level playing field for everyone to participate. One of the great examples of this is some of the work that we've been doing with schools and districts around developing their own framework for culturally relevant and responsive sustaining education. Those have been curriculum frameworks, those have been pedagogical frameworks, those have been assessment frameworks, but in creating a framework and developing shared language within the community, everyone has ownership over that language. We all know what we mean, and now we can start from a place of common ground. We can start from a place of common understanding, as opposed to, you know, kind of assuming that everybody just knows what I'm talking about because I know about it, or everyone agrees with me because I know about it. We don't have to always agree on everything all the time. But let's at least agree on, like, what language can we use to talk about this, or what are the experiences that other people have brought to the table, and how are we discussing these things? But I think that in the same ways that thinking about myself, my identity in the community, or thinking about curriculum can have these surprising challenges, that entry point of that looking at those shared texts can also have some challenges. And in particular, I think the challenge that we've already discussed is, like, sort of being surprised at the emotional connections and the ways in which I feel either open towards the reflection, or I feel sort of like shame. I may feel ashamed. I may feel shamed. I may feel defensive. I may feel closed off. I may feel confused. So any number of these feelings may come up. And so I think a promising practice, a pro tip, if you will, for coaching in these spaces is to be able to name emotions and to be able to help people to find the emotions using something like an emotions wheel or a feelings chart or a mood meter. Those are really great ways to help people connect just with their own heart and mind, and then being able to be able to communicate that. We're in a really powerful place in a community where we can say, I just learned about this and I'm thinking a lot about it. It's giving me pause for these reasons. I'm feeling a little uncomfortable, but I'm going to sustain in this conversation in these ways, or I need to take some time to think about that. I'd like to return later. Giving people that language to be able to connect with themselves and then also enter the conversation at the point that they're ready for is a really great way to make sure that the work doesn't stop when we get uncomfortable. The work starts when you get uncomfortable, but it doesn't continue unless we can persevere through that space. And having some language and protocols for talking about our emotions is really important. Coaching for change is really hard, you guys.
A little bit.
But we're in agreement that it cannot happen if we ignore or pretend that cultural identity and our cultural landscape has nothing to do with our work. And that's really the point of CRSP, that we're going to enter every project with a belief that our cultural identity is valued and valuable, that we're better with diversity, and that being able to meet people where they are from the different cultural experiences that they've had is actually a shortcut to their learning and a shortcut to their growth. But we know that it's challenging and it's relatively new in the history of education, teaching, and learning. So as we bring our conversation to a close today, I just want to invite each of you to share, you know, anything for facilitators who are beginning to facilitate this work. Any words of advice?
I think one of the things I find that's always helpful is not being afraid to be vulnerable and to talk about some of the mistakes and the challenges and the lessons that we've learned. And I think in some ways that can invite others to be open and know that you can fall down and you can just get right back up. So I think that's something that coaches can really give to their communities.
I think also something like, we use this in our community, but a permission slip, like saying, I'd like to use my permission slip to wait a minute before I speak. I'm having a lot of feelings come up. I'm feeling upset. I'm feeling like I should take action, but I don't know what to do. So I want to just use my permission. Now, the permission slip is like a made up permission slip, right? Nobody's telling somebody what they're supposed to do and not do, but there is like a social.
I don't know, Faith. My mom signed mine.
I mean, there's certainly a social pressure, though, especially if you have a protocol. Now I have to speak. Now I have to say something, but I'm feeling overwhelmed by emotion. So I'd like to use my permission slip to skip a turn. I'd like to use my permission slip to talk about something from last week. I had thought about it all week and I am upset. And here's what I'd like to talk about. Is there
a lot of this work as coaches is about thoughtful and open communication? I'm hearing vulnerability, giving ourselves permission, allowing others permission. So it's really about striving to create spaces where if we're open and vulnerable and we lay the groundwork with some protocols and we're openly communicating and supporting people to openly communicate and not make assumptions about each other and sort of working through that, that we can really get a lot of this work done. And so I think opening up lines of communication through the protocols, through being vulnerable ourselves and modeling it, and not shooting people down, even if they are making assumptions or they are uncomfortable or are expressing biases, to expect that and expect to treat everybody in the conversation with the same level of respect and sort of positive intentions.
That was mine, Courtney. Thanks for stealing it.
Oh, I stole it. Well, great minds, right? A mind meld. Mind meld.
No, that was the tip that I wanted to really highlight, is just to assume the best intention. I've never met an educator who wanted to be bad at their job. Everyone wants to do their job well. I've never met a person who's like, intention is like to be unkind to other people. So the reality, if I put in my mind that everyone has the best intention, then it creates me the opportunity to be curious when folks come to the table with different perspectives than my own, because I have to ask myself, what is the landscape of the world that they're looking at if this is their best intention? And it challenges me to create opportunities for empathy, to relate to folks that have very different perspectives than my own. And I may not end up walking away going like, wow, I completely agree. But what I can do is at least to say, I want to always get to a point where I can say, I can understand based on your lived experiences how you might see the world in this way. And when I can do that, then I can, my second tip is anticipate. If this is your lived experience and this is the perspective you have on the world, then here's how you might receive what I have to share, or here's how you might perceive or feel challenged by the work that we're going to be doing. And as a result, that changes how I approach, that changes how I might frame, that changes how much background I provide, how much research I bring, how much vulnerability I bring. So those are my two recommendations for promising practices. Part one is assume the best intent and then try to understand, empathize from that person's lived experience. And then two, using that information, anticipate how my people respond to what I'm bringing and how does that anticipation help me to plan to meet them where they are. This is Teaching Today and Coaching for Change. I want to say a big thank you to my special guests, G. Faith Little, Courtney Brown, and Cherise Holloman.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A shout out to our post-production crew, Katie Milks and G. Faith Little. We think your voice matters. Send us your education questions, concerns, and promising practices, and we'll address them. You can subscribe to Teaching Today and leave a review. And thanks for participating in Coaching for Change. Follow us on social media where you can find us at TCCPET or send an email to cpet@tc.edu. We'll be back in your feed next time. Until then, everybody now,
take care.
And talk soon.